Welcome to Walking in Faith, featuring interviews and reviews that help you rediscover the Catholic faith in our culture. And now here is your host, Barbara Schenkel.
Welcome to Walking in Faith. First up, we have a number of interviews that I recorded at the March for Life this January. We'll be speaking with John Henry Weston, the founder of LifeSite News. He's going to update us on something that's happening in Canada as it relates to pro-life students. Then we'll be speaking with Patrick Cross from Thomas Aquinas College. He's going to give us an update on how the college has fared since the fire that broke out there late last year. And our final interview from the March for Life will be with Abby Johnson. She's going to talk about how the pro-life advocacy that she's doing now, a former worker at Planned Parenthood, and she came out of that and had a huge change in her life with regard to her personal life. So she'll speak about that too. And then we'll speak with Matt Gambino. He is the editor of Catholic Philly. They recently launched a six-part series on opioid addiction and the crisis in Philadelphia, and he'll give us the update on that. And then we'll close the show with an interview with a talk by Father Gregory Pine. He was speaking to a group from St. Andrews on the topic of suffering. So we'll bring you those interviews right now, and I hope you enjoy the show.
So we'll leave it at that.
Thank you.
This is John Henry Weston, the co-founder and editor-in-chief at LifeSiteNews.com. And we are a pro-life, pro-family news agency originating in Canada, now in the USA, Rome, and all over the world. And I have a very special message, and that is pay attention now to what's going on in Canada. The Prime Minister of Canada, Justin Trudeau, has just issued a regulation forbidding anybody who is pro-life or pro-family from receiving a grant. Now, all businesses in Canada get to apply for a grant to hire summer students. And for the first time ever, there's a specific requirement that employers sign on to a document that says that they support abortion and they support LGBT rights in order to be able to receive this grant. This grant is funded by public dollars, so it's a taxpayer grant made available to businesses so that they can bring on summer students more easily. It's a great win for the businesses, obviously, but also for the students who get the experience. Well, we now have a regulation from the government, from the Prime Minister, saying you can't be pro-life or pro-family and get this government benefit. The scary part about that is, while it's a huge violation of freedom, religious freedom as well, it's also a very scary harbinger of what's coming next. Because in Canada, healthcare is a public service as well. In Canada, old age pension is also given as a public service based on tax dollars like everything else. Well, if you're required to sign on for that benefit for the summer jobs, it makes sense that in the future they're going to have the same requirement for old age security or for unemployment insurance, all these public benefits. And that gets to be really concerning because immediately you have now a requirement where you're required to sign on the dotted line that you support abortion rights, that you support LGBT.
This is very scary. Has anyone brought this forward in the courts with regards to discrimination?
It's being done right now. This just happened. So we actually broke the story at LifeSite News some 3 weeks ago. A lot of people, I think, didn't believe it because it was so bizarre. Sure enough, it checked out. The mainstream media finally reported it. The evangelical leadership in Canada and the Catholic leadership just made statements against it in the last few days. So this is brand new. We have a petition on LifeSite News asking for the government to revoke this. And we're hoping that many sign on to it, especially those who aren't from Canada, so we can show this is an embarrassment for Canadians all over the world. We're trying to pretend to be a free country when we're actually restricting religious rights, restricting pro-life rights. And it's like they want to say you can't be a good Canadian citizen unless you support abortion. And that's absolutely insane.
And you say this is the toe in the tent with regards to all kinds of public benefits that you might not be able to be partaking of if you have a conservative pro-life view.
Absolutely. They're making it like a requirement to say that you're a good Canadian citizen. And if that's the case, soon enough we'll be required to say we're a good Canadian citizen in order to get even a credit card or a bank account. So this could be the launch of something truly macabre in Canada.
Can I ask you something? In America, it's about 50-50, maybe going a little higher with regard to pro-life conservative issues. What is it in Canada, and what is the sense in terms of public outrage?
Unfortunately, it's true that the law is a teacher, and we have had abortion up to and including basically 9 months of pregnancy, all at taxpayer expense since the 1980s. We legalized abortion in 1969, a few years, 4 years before the United States. So we are sort of further down the hill, if you will. And so, yes, there is a majority who are in favor of, killing children in their mother's wombs. But as sad as that is, we've got to turn it back to a culture of life. And the one of the ways to do that is to actually capture the media, because the media, both the public media in Canada and the private, is almost completely anti-life, anti-family, without any exception. Unlike America, we don't have a Fox News in Canada. You know, we have only alternative news like LifeSite News and other agencies that get into Canada, but we have no mainstream conservative news agency at all.
Is this fear or hubris on the part of the Prime Minister? Is it that, what would he have to fear about conservatives being in internships in industry, or is it the hubris of, like, let's finally put them out of the country?
I am afraid to say I think it's the latter. This is the first Prime Minister of Canada who's actually a product of the new form of education, anti-life, anti-family education. By the way, he received it all in Catholic schools. He is a Catholic, unlike the United States, which has had many presidents who were anti-life, sure, but they weren't Catholic. Justin Trudeau is a Catholic. He's actually the son of Pierre Elliott Trudeau, who is also a Catholic, who is the one who legalized abortion in Canada and homosexuality as well. But Justin is actually, by the way, Justin still appears on the cover of newspapers in Canada receiving Holy Communion, but at the same time is one of the most outspoken pro-abortion, pro-same-sex marriage leaders of the country. And yet, he comes at this from a position of, no, this is the Catholic Church. This is what it should be. He's very convinced in his stance, sees it as a stance of human rights. It's almost like he has it as a religious value. As an oddity, because he calls it a Canadian value. He's actively alienated anyone in Canada who's pro-life. And when the bishops spoke out against this new regulation that he had, he was actually surprised. He was saying, I thought it would only be, anti-abortion activists. And so, God willing, he gets to wake up. But I'm not all that hopeful, only because he is so entrenched in this belief system himself.
And the violence of the abortion to the woman's womb, as well as to the unborn child, he does not see that as a human right?
He doesn't see it at all. They only see this in terms of women's rights and nothing else. They're unwilling to accept the humanity of the unborn. And as I was saying earlier, they accept it as a religious value. It's a value that comes from indoctrination. So it doesn't matter what the scientific evidence is supporting life in the womb. It doesn't matter at all. It's pushed away as if it doesn't exist. And so it is a movement of faith more so than reason. And so he comes at that actually exactly the same way as he comes to the LGBT issues. Because when we know that the sexual behavior that's involved there causes harm to the body, all of that is ignored and pushed away. It doesn't matter because it's superseded by this sort of quasi-religious belief that said these are human rights, these are the rights we need to pursue. It doesn't matter what the science says.
Well, John, keep up the good work, good all that LifeSite News is doing. I know that I can't go a day without checking it to see what's going on. So thanks for all you do.
Thank you, Barbara. Great to be with you, and God bless you.
And here's the interview with Abby Johnson, the former Planned Parenthood worker.
When we became pro-life, when we got involved in the movement, I mean, our convictions changed even before we were involved in the movement. And that changed our marriage. That changed who we were as a couple, who we were to each other. And there was a lot of healing that had to take place in our marriage, because we had not been living, you know, a godly marriage, a marriage that was centered on Christ. And so there was a lot of that that had to take place. And once we sort of moved through that period in our life of healing and restoration in our marriage, and really being committed to each other and saying, no matter how hard this gets, we're going to stick it out. We're going to stick with it. Once we moved through that, then this sort of natural openness to life came to both of us. And we, you know, our family began to expand very quickly. We have 7 children. Our daughter, when I left Planned Parenthood, was 2. She turned 3 like a month later. And then a few years later, we had our son, Alex. And then 10 and a half months later, we had our son, Luke. And then 13 months later, we had our son, Carter. And then 6 months later, we were gifted a child through adoption. And then just 8 months ago, I had twin girls. And so God has really blessed us, and it has required us to rely solely on Him for His help. And in the way that we parent, in the way that we are a family, in the way that we interact with each other. But, you know, I can't... I look back at our marriage, how it was when I worked at Planned Parenthood. And honestly, I don't feel like we were even really in a marriage. It was just sort of this agreement that we had made to each other. It was not sacramental. It was not holy. There was no reach for holiness, right? It was very self-centered. And now it's really just a constant giving to each other and giving to our children. And I can say, I mean, I really believe that without the Catholic Church, our marriage may not have made it. But learning about what marriage is and the sacrament that marriage is was really a turning point in our relationship.
Abby, would you ever consider doing a book for even people who have sacramental marriages, who may be contracepting or using some kind of barrier in their marriage that they need to figure out the way back?
Yeah, my husband and I have actually talked about that.
Oh my goodness, well, this is confirmation.
Yeah, we've actually talked about doing something like that because we were contracepting the first few years of our marriage. Even after I left Planned Parenthood, we were contracepting for a while. And, you know, like God seems to do all things in my life, it was a very dramatic moment when I decided I cannot do this anymore. This is wrong. And then, you know, now I'm an NFP instructor and we use NFP in our marriage and find that to be so fulfilling, even though it's hard. It has challenges, certainly. Anybody that says NFP is easy is a liar. But it's the grace that you receive in your marriage through planning your family through God's way, and it's beautiful. And so we actually have considered doing something together and writing about it sort of from his perspective and my perspective and writing about it as a couple.
And just giving people sort of a guide map through those little moments at which you want to just say, this is too hard, I can't do it.
Yeah, and it is hard. I mean, and there were certainly times in our marriage where I've said, this is hard, I don't want to do this anymore, you know? And then Doug will say, I know it's hard, but, you know, this is what we need to be doing. And then there's times where he's like, this is hard, I don't want to do this anymore. And, you know, it's that constant just reminding each other of why we're doing this and that we are seeking holiness in our marriage. The primary thing that society doesn't talk about in marriage is that at the end of the day, we are striving for holiness as a couple. We're striving to help each other become closer and closer to Christ. Because it's not about ourselves, right? It's marriage is sort of the sacrament of marriage, sort of dying to self and living for this other person, right? And then when you have children, living for them and being sacrificial, you know, in that way. And always self-sacrificing for your spouse and for your child. It's not always about you. It's not, and that's really the society that we live in. We sort of live in this me society. It's all about me, and what I want. I'm not happy, so I'm going to get a divorce. He's not doing this for me, so I'm going to leave. And you know, and really not striving to find Jesus together. And that's where I feel like we're missing. People look, they get into marriage thinking, well, there is a way out if I want to get out.
Yeah.
Instead of saying, this is forever, no matter what, I'm going to be with you forever, and I'm going to be on this road, and it's going to be hard sometimes, but we're going to keep moving forward. We're going to keep moving closer and closer to Christ together.
Thank you so much, Abby, and I hope that book gets written.
Yes.
And here's Patrick Cross from Thomas Aquinas College.
Tell us a little bit about the uniqueness of this college.
So St. Thomas Aquinas College was founded in 1971, and it was founded at a time where there was a decline in Catholic higher education. And really, it was founded because the founders of the college wanted to offer an authentically Catholic education that was loyal to the magisterium of the Catholic Church. And so they founded it. And what really makes it very unique is the fact that the core curriculum is the curriculum. So there is no electives, majors, or minors. Every student is receiving the same degree. When you attend the college, all of your classes are set. So that's very unique. Then the approach we take to that specific program is unique because every single class is discussion-based. So there are no lectures in the 4 years that you attend the college. So even in the math and science courses, you are discussing among yourselves. So there's a professor who is there to facilitate and guide discussion, but as much as possible, it's the professor wants the students to engage the material in front of them and come to the correct conclusions through their own intellectual prowess and ability and pursuit. So when you have a discussion-based curriculum, the night before you know that I better, just simply for utilitarian purposes, if nothing else, you better get it down because your classmates are depending on you, because it really is a discussion-based program. So you get out of it what you and your classmates put into it. So yeah, you can't fake your way through it.
Well, so many of our listeners are curious about what happened to the college with the recent fire, known as the Thomas Fire, because it was so adjacent to the college. How are you guys faring and what happened?
So we are fine now. It's miraculous because the fire started about 3 miles, my understanding is 3 miles from the campus. We evacuated the students within, I think, 45 minutes of us becoming aware of this. So it was a very quick turnaround time, and we got the students to a local parish initially and then to different houses of friends of the college throughout the community. So we weathered it as well as could have been hoped for. And then the fire completely surrounded the campus. Literally all four sides of the campus were surrounded. Only there was a few members of the maintenance crew and the president of the college and his wife and one of our chaplains who decided they wanted to stay on campus and help out the firefighters who were on the campus. So none of the structures were damaged, I think except for one like storage container. But it made it through miraculously. So we missed, I think, a week or two of classes. But we're able to start up the second semester as normal, and we're doing just fine now. I mean, there are some expenses related to, you know, just trees that were downed on the property and things like that. But we're doing well, and with God's help, we'll keep going.
Do you think the prayers helped save the institute, the structures?
Oh my gosh, definitely. Yeah, TAC has always been in the hands of God since the very beginning. There's been so many times when it was clear that, you know, God's providence was involved with the preservation of the campus physically and in all other ways. the fire started on December 4th, which I believe is the Feast of St. Barbara. And she is often invoked against fires. So I think that's right. My theology might be off on that, but I'm pretty sure that's the case. And so I think that's a little providential sign as
well. I do too. I think she's the patron of firefighters as well.
That might be right. Thanks. She stops fire.
And she did in this case too. Thank you so much.
Thank you. God bless.
Good morning. This morning we're speaking with Matt Gambino. He is the publisher of CatholicPhilly.com. Welcome, Matt.
Good morning, Barbara.
Well, as I was contemplating the new year, I was thinking about what some of the most important stories that hit Philly.com last year, and one of them undoubtedly had to be your taking on the opioid crisis epidemic. You did a six-part series. What was it that prompted you to do that?
Well, I was really led by our senior content producer, Gina Christian. She really took the lead on this. And it's really coming from a place of compassion and our mission to try to address issues in the community from a Catholic perspective. And so we took a look at this epidemic that really is destroying not only the individuals who are enslaved by these drugs, but also causing untold suffering in their families and in their communities. So it's really, these are not isolated incidents. They're not individuals on an island. They really are members of families and communities that are dealing with this tragedy in a very intense way. So we thought we wanted to try to bring to bear some of the spiritual resources, pastoral resources of the church in this area, and how can we help people to address the crisis.
You kick off with the Cathedral of Kensington, the church, the former church, Ascension of Our Lord, and has now become sort of a haven for addicts. Why was that important to lead off the series with that Catholic, such a Catholic image?
Well, at the time when we published the story in last July, it was becoming notorious for people living there. Yeah. Now the church has been closed, and I believe it's been sold, but it's basically a hulk, and folks had broken in there. It was a clean, dry place to live, and unfortunately to continue their habit. But there were people there, and those people were being ministered to by Mother of Mercy House, which is a relatively new Catholic outreach in the Kensington area. And the priest and sister from there and then the lay people in that new community are reaching out to the addicts in that area, and they knew that they were at this former church. So they tried to visit them. And so this got a little bit of notoriety in the media, and we thought, let's see what's going on there. So we went to talk to the Mother of Mercy House ministry team, and we got an inside look at that former church. And the scenes were very sad, but the folks there, the people living there, were pleased to see that there was a Catholic presence checking up on them and interested in their well-being. And when the priests and sisters showed up, they thought, boy, what time is Mass? Is there going to have Mass here again? Although this church is really it's a deplorable state right now. I think there was a fire there recently as well. So as much as authorities try to seal the church up, people do break in and they continue to use it as a place to continue their habit.
Now, in the comments section of the series, some people asked, why weren't those priests assigned to this church and keep the church going?
It's a very complicated answer, but the parish was closed years ago because of, declining demographics in that area and the age of the building. And it's the same story about parish closures throughout the diocese and throughout this country, in fact. We are a changing demographic, we're a changing country, we're a changing religious population as well. People are mobile, they're moving away from these old traditional neighborhoods, and the parish simply could not sustain the buildings and the ministry to that people with the number of Catholics left in that area. So what you have is a closed parish, then a closed church, that there are other churches in that area, but this particular one at Ascension was too big to be supported by the Catholic community now existing in that area. So, but there are still people there. So there was a really innovation by two diocesan priests who said, let's set up a storefront ministry type of thing. And they called that Mother of Mercy, and Archbishop Shapu agreed to this proposal. And so it is a real innovation where there is ministry going on among people that doesn't depend upon very large castle-like structures that are extremely expensive to maintain. And that's the situation we have today with Mother of Mercy House, which operates as a very small ministry from a storefront in that community. But there are Catholic resources there ministering to the people, not so much to the buildings.
Yeah.
But I think what we need to do is we need a really clear-eyed look of the present and what we're doing right now. But you can say, well, why are we spending so much money on Catholic education? Should we be spending that on social services? Why are we spending so much on social services? Should we be spending that on spirituality? Why are we spending money on spirituality? Shouldn't we be spending on that education? Digging around and around and around.
Right.
We do the best we can with the money that we have available. And every family is like this. Communities are like this. There are limited funds and lots of needs. We try to address all of them with the resources that we have.
Matt, have you ever spoken to the Archbishop about this? Is he aware? I'm sure he's aware of Kensington and the needs that are there. Is he thinking of anything forward-looking with regards to the problems that are there and how it can be better addressed, or is he happy with what's happening with Mercy House?
Well, I don't know that he's happy with the situations that we face, but I think he is encouraged by the efforts that he's seeing at Mother of Mercy House, and I can't really speak for him, but I think the evidence is there that there are some efforts developing. Mother of Mercy House is one in Kensington. Our House Ministries in Grays Ferry, another area with its significant troubles, but again, significant ministry.
Yeah.
There are suburban parishes that are trying to say, look, this issue exists not just in city neighborhoods, it exists in suburban communities as well. This thing transcends socioeconomic barriers, zip codes, you name it. This opioid epidemic is a real epidemic, and it addresses people from every age and every walk of life. That's why these efforts are popping up in city and suburb. Now, I will say that a coordinated response is becoming more needed every day.
Right.
We're seeing individual ministries, some courageous efforts from folks, both clergy, religious, and lay. But I, for one, would love to see a more coordinated response. But that's kind of above my pay grade.
Yes. Well, let's go back to the series, because we're going to get to that. We should point out that Philadelphia is unique in that it has higher overdose rates than Chicago and New York, according to what you were reporting. And that was stunning to me, that there is a specific demographic that exceeds sort of national averages here in Philadelphia. So there is that acute need, as you point out. And you also go in the series to talk about what we're doing here and whether or not, you went into the spirituality of addiction, whether that's a sin or, taking drugs is a sin, which I found was very interesting. Talk a little bit about that.
Well, what we did was we talked to a couple of moral theologians, try to offer some perspective on it. It's too easy to paint with a broad brush to say, well, someone's addicted, that's their fault. They're making these choices to throw their lives away, and why should I care? Or they're just sinful. If they would just repent of their sin and go to confession, and they'd be back on track. Well, with this, if we were talking for the last several minutes, these issues are not as easy as that. They're complex, and so we're trying to unpack the complexity. So we talked to some moral theologians, and we talked about the nature of sin. We talked about the nature of freedom, and that's what this addiction crisis really boils down to. It's a matter of slavery. One's freedom to make right choices is being diminished by this drug. So we can't really say, in all honesty, as good Catholics, that this addiction problem is a matter of weakness, and if these were better kind of people, then they wouldn't have this problem, and I wouldn't have to be bothered by news reports about their death. We need a more compassionate response than that, and we need some understanding of the nature of addiction, that this is an impingement upon one's freedom. It's a kind of slavery, and it's a public health issue as well.
Right.
And there is the Catechism of the Catholic Church speaks about sin, mortal and venial, but talks about this impingement on freedom, and that's what we need to understand, or again, this is one part of our series trying to do that.
Yes. In fact, the Pontifical Academy of Sciences, which you quote in one of those stories, says addiction destroys autonomy and free will, which is the hallmark of the Christian or the human likeness to God. So it's destroying the very likeness of God in man, the ability to choose freely.
We were born free people.
Yeah.
And we are redeemed by Christ's sacrifice. And that's an important thing to remember. The other thing is that with this addiction crisis and with any kind of issue in dealing with the human person, we're more than just physical beings. So this is, the addiction is more than just this physical need for the drug, and addressing addiction is more than just naloxone or something that will pull the person back from the brink using one chemical to counteract another chemical and treating just the body alone. There is a spiritual component to this addiction, and that's something that the Catholic perspective brings to bear as society tries to come to grips with treating this addiction crisis, that we need to treat the whole person, body and soul. And Catholic spirituality, Christian spirituality, a deep faith really has to be addressed as one makes progress on the path to recovery.
Indeed. And let's now talk about Father Douglas McKay, because he embodies exactly what you're talking about. Talk a little bit about his life. I mean, I was fascinated to find out that as a child, he used to take meals that his mother cooked to people who were alcoholics on the street, and his mother would make him wait to bring the fork and the plate back. But I guess Father McKay really embodies the fact that he believes the most powerful tool we have in our toolbox as Catholics is the Blessed Sacrament, and really, really insists that it be in a tabernacle where these people who are struggling, you know, you talked about this not just being a physical but a spiritual battle as well, that they have the Blessed Sacrament available to them. I loved his quote when he said, "We're not protecting the Blessed Sacrament by being afraid to keep it in these churches and have people come in and adore our Lord. He's protecting us."
Yeah. Yeah, and there's Father McKay is just a good, holy man who has really dedicated his life to keeping the presence of Christ in neighborhoods that need it so much. His Our House Ministries in Grays Ferry, yes, they're trying to address the human problem and human needs, but again, as I mentioned, we are both body and soul, and so this presence of Christ in the Blessed Sacrament, in the community, in the neighborhoods, in these homes, in his Our House Ministries right there, it's key to any kind of recovery, both as individuals and as a society. And not everyone, you know, will even understand the Eucharist or know that it's just down the street at this ministry. But that's our job as Catholics, is to spread the good news, especially to this situation or communities that need Christ so badly. Christ is present among us, and his people are here to help one another.
And, that,
and so,
do you
Father McKay's deep spirituality and commitment is really one of the great assets that we have.
And Matt, do you think that we as a community, a Catholic community, are doing enough to pray for this crisis? I was very impressed when I was reading about Father McKay, and they started Calyx because a priest was struggling with alcohol, and the only way that they could really help him was to start a 5 a.m. Mass and pray for his sobriety, and it really kind of worked. If prayer is very powerful, too. Are we employing those forces in our parishes?
I don't think so. At least not, again, as I say, in a coordinated way. Now, what I have noticed is over the past year, more and more masses are popping up at parishes to pray for people who are addicted. And these masses are drawing not only people in recovery, but family members of people who are in recovery or actively using. Because, again, this is more than just the individuals. It's a family problem and a community problem. So, again, in a perfect world, I'd love to see prayers for people who are addicted in general intercessions at every mass, at every parish. But what we have right now is kind of a grassroots burgeoning sense that we do need to pray. And so we're starting to see more of these masses being celebrated in parishes, both in city and suburb. But there's certainly more of a commitment, I think, that we need to make to pray for people, because this is a modern-day slavery, and slavery has to be addressed with the power of the Spirit as well.
Wow, Matt, very, very well put. The other thing I was very impressed with in your series is the 14-point action plan put in front by the Diocese of Greensburg. And you had referenced earlier a coordinated effort. Part of that was just education for people to know how to deal with people in their parish to deal with addiction. Sometimes this is something that many people don't want anyone to know about. They're embarrassed by it. Also, homily, preaching tools, family recovery groups. Is that what you were thinking about in terms of coordinated plans?
Well, I think there's a number of things that I'm thinking of. For instance, we have a story on St. Norbert Parish in Paoli. They are doing a coordinated response in their parish because a man there had this issue in his family and couldn't find any Catholic resources. So he decided to start making them at his parish. And there's a number of other Catholics doing the same thing. So I think efforts are bubbling up, but coordinating from within a parish community, family to family, and then parish to parish, and across a diocese, and from diocese to diocese and state, and across the country. I think what's bubbling up now, my hope is that that would become more and more organized over time, so that 1, 2, 3, 5 years from now, you will see a well-coordinated plan being implemented from parish to parish and diocese to diocese across the country, because it's not just in Northeast United States as well. You know,
Midwest,
areas of the country experiencing this.
Was this on the USCCB at all on their agenda items, how does that sort of portend in the future with regards to the Council of Bishops?
Well, I think it will most certainly will be, because bishops are pastors, and pastors know their people. They know that this issue is becoming more and more intense. So I think what you're going to see first is some of these experiments that we're seeing in the Philadelphia Archdiocese of how to address the physical and spiritual nature of addiction with Catholic resources that we've been outlining in our series. How do we roll that out across the diocese? How do we have a parish-based toolkit to do that? And once those things start bubbling up and start becoming firm and put into place, then I think you will start seeing bishops at the bishops' conference level, on a national level, saying the need is great, and we've been trying this in our diocese, and we'd like to share this with the other bishops in this conference. And that's how I think a national plan will start to come about, because the need is there, but the compassion is there as well. And as I say, bishops are pastors, and they're always looking out for ways to improve the spiritual and physical health of the people they serve.
And it's also a timely issue in that the president is addressing this on a national level.
There's a long history in the Philadelphia Archdiocese of public-private partnerships, not only with the federal government, but with the state and local governments, city and county. So I think the church will continue to look at those partnerships, and those government entities will be looking at the church as well, because Catholic ministries have always been able to deliver social services in a very efficient, cost-efficient way. So we can leverage public dollars in very efficient, very effective ways because they have a lot of experience in doing it. You know, I think of the federal agricultural money going into feeding programs in the Archdiocese of Philadelphia run by Nutritional Development Services. I think of nursing facilities that we develop keep seniors in their own communities, leveraging state dollars. And we look at the services that Catholic Social Services organization renders for at-risk youth, which leverages local city and county money. So the experience is there to be able to use those sorts of resources in very effective ways. And again, I think that the grassroots things that are bubbling up right now, these kind of efforts to address the problem, are just the first ground level of our response, which then will become hopefully coordinated with resources, both public and private. And that's another thing that is important. Catholic social services and all this church's efforts in that realm really are supported greatly by the Catholic Charities Appeal and other charities that are private dollars going to meet needs that are so prevalent among us.
One of the wonderful effects of journalism when done right is that it can affect change. Do you see anything, any response with regards to the Archdiocese? Who in the Archdiocese would be coordinating this, if anyone? Can you think of a department, or has there been any
right
since?
Now. Yeah, right now there is no one coordinating. And I think, again, I mentioned that I think it's something that is needed. I think we do need a more coordinated response to take a look at some of the grassroots things that are happening right now and learn from them some best practices from Mother of Mercy House, what's been their experience, from Father Doug McKay's ministries, the ministries in the suburbs and those parishes. What are they doing that's working, and how can we do it better in an organized way? I would think that Catholic Human Services, as an umbrella delivering services to the community, whether they're Catholic or not, that's been our MO for 200-some years now, that we serve all people, regardless of socioeconomic background or religious creed. We'd probably be best poised to address this in an organized way. And I don't know that that is happening, but it may be.
Yes. Well, Matt, thanks to your series, you're right, it may be. And it's certainly pointing out a problem that if we want to look, we can possibly address. So I just applaud you and your team over there for doing such a great job in highlighting the opioid crisis, not only in the Catholic faith, but in the city of Philadelphia. So thank you so much, Matt, for your time this morning explaining that.
Thank you, Barbara. And readers are welcome to check out that series by going to CatholicPhilly.com and looking at our opioid crisis series.
Thanks, Matt.
And here's the talk by Father Gregory Pine.
So here are some just like principles about to think fruitfully about suffering. Okay. There are seven. They're pretty short. I'll just give like a little explanation of each. First, God is provident beyond our imagining. As much as you want the best for everyone, God wants it all the more and then some. He loves your destiny and that of all men with an unfathomably zealous desire. So that is to say, to quote 1 Timothy 2:4, God desires that all be saved and come to knowledge of the truth. And God's desire is efficacious, more so than mine. Like, I desire to be, I don't know, an excellent soccer player, but that means nothing. whereas God's desire is fruitful and creative, okay? So when we say that God is provident beyond our imagining, that's to say that he loves your destiny more than you can even begin to love it, okay? So to ask, like, God, why are you against, is an ill-begotten question, you know? Granted, it's like kind of a question of the Psalms, so it can be a fruitful way to engage with the Lord, but all of our prayers are always underwritten by the confidence that God is prompting us, he is leading us, he is encouraging us towards the good. So that's the first one. Second one. All suffering is a result of sin. All right? Good to know. Moral evil and the havoc that it wreaks in human society is not part of God's perfect will for man, though he permits it in light of the fall. Okay? So there's always going to be like some physical evil. All right? So God created animals, and he created lions, and he created antelopes. And lions have sharp teeth, and antelopes are delicious. Okay? So it was just immediately attendant upon the fact of his creation that when you have certain things, other things are going to die as a result. Okay? The building up of one biological thing means the dwindling of another. Okay? So, like, physical evil was always going to be part of the world. But moral evil was never part of God's intention. He never intended that we fear and betray each other, that we choose against him or reject the dispensation of grace. Okay? That being said, God's will accounts for our choice, okay? And it's not just like God is readjusting in light of what we choose as if God were learning from us. That is not the case, all right? But God wills that free things happen freely. So part of his plan accommodates for our, you know, defective wills. It's somehow better that God created things that were not just automatic robots that would fulfill his will as if by instinct, but he made us to grow into it, to choose it, all right? And in so doing, he admits the possibility that we will betray him. And yet, somehow it's better that he made things as he did, okay? There's a kind of air of freedom. There's an air of, I don't know, beauty to it. It's somehow better. I can't tell you exactly how, but it is. All right, so that's two. Moral evil is the fruit of our own evil choice. Third, life on earth is not ordered to contentment or to present happiness. So C.S. Lewis has this beautiful image. He says, if you take a group of people and you put them all in the same building, okay, and you tell half of them you're in a hotel, and you tell the other half of them that you're in a prison, but in truth of fact, you bring them to like an athletic facility, okay, the people who think that they're in a hotel are going to be sorely disappointed. This place smells like sweat, you know. The people who think that they're in a prison are going to be elated. Wow, I am not confined, okay? So life on Earth is something like an athletic facility. It's a training ground, okay? It is not designed as like an all-inclusive resort to attend to our every need, nor is it a prison, okay? But it is something on the way, all right? It's made as a kind of anteroom to heaven, and so we treat it accordingly, all right? So the fact that we would experience some difficulty on Earth should come as no surprise, okay? All good things, well-gotten, entail struggle, you know? So that's number three. Number four. God would not permit evil to befall unless he could bring about from it some greater good. So that the martyr's testimony is dependent on the torturer's persecution. All right? St. Augustine was able to sing, "O happy fault, which merited for us such a Savior." So God is not defeated. God is not overcome by our moral evil. He is not overcome by our fell choice. All right? But he only ever permits it to bring about from it some greater good. Okay? The beauty of repentance is somehow better than innocence. I can't explain how, but it somehow is. Okay? And so too, the beauty of having a Redeemer in Jesus Christ is somehow better than persevering in our original state. Not in a strict sense, you know? We don't sin that grace abound all the more. We don't say, like, I'm going to sin eight times so that Jesus can, like, you know, forgive me eight times today. That's not what we do, all right? We try to work in accord with the grace that he gives, and yet it's somehow better. Okay. Number five. God is taking all the sin and suffering, every ugly aspect of man's story, and constructing with it a kind of monument of mercy. So rather than saying, look how horrible that is, we can say instead, look what the mercy of God will redeem in its time. So in Ecclesiastes 3, we read, God makes all things beautiful in its time. Part of being human is living in time and in space, all right? So we come to, you know, we come to basically into our destiny as the fruit of choices, all right? We're not like angels where intuitively we know all that is and we make one choice that is simply for all eternity. Rather, we live for 70 years or 80 for those who are strong, says the Psalms, okay? And as a result, God gives us an extended lease on life so that we could be in pursuit of him, so that we could respond to his offer of grace, okay? So he permits sin and suffering to befall as somehow part of the drama of our redemption. There's a Christian author of the last century, Luigi Gisani, who's often quoted in the Magnificat. He said, regret is not a Christian sentiment because the Christian looks with redeemed eyes on the past and says and is able to appreciate how God was working even there. Even in the midst of my betrayal, even in the midst of my ugliest choice. That's five. Number six. Suffering only begins to make sense in light of the cross. Jesus Christ suffered and died so that we might not suffer alone. That is to say, there's always something like personalistic about suffering. So Jesus does not answer the meaning of suffering in the abstract. He doesn't give us a series of principles from which we can deduce why it is that this thing happened now. Like, Lord, I have an ingrown toenail. Clearly, that is to redound to the glory of someone in the nation of Chad. Like, Lord, I have a toothache. Clearly, that is to redound to the glory of someone in the sovereign nation of Zimbabwe. No, there's no strange calculus about it. Like, this evil thing for that good thing. This evil thing for that good thing. It's only in the context of a relationship with Jesus Christ. Okay? Because that is all we're really ever promised in Christian life. Jesus doesn't say, like, come follow me, and I'll give you a nice car, and you'll smell good, and you'll never suffer from halitosis. He says, like, come and follow me, and you'll get me. And for whatever reason, suffering is a privileged place of encounter with Jesus Christ. Because the only time that it makes sense is when you're looking him in the face. When you look away, it's like, ah, yikes. But when you're looking him in the face, not only it begins to make sense, but he makes sense all the more. How did the disciples recognize Jesus in the Gospel of John? By his wounds. Okay? So, last one. Recognize that you'll never have a complete answer. Perhaps not even in heaven. Now, I don't mean to say that heaven will not be comprehensive in a certain sense, but we will never be able to grasp all of God, okay? So we are like owls before the noonday sun of his radiant glory. And the whole mystery of suffering is part of the mystery of the revelation of Jesus Christ, which in a certain sense will always exceed our capacity. So in heaven, I suspect it will be the case that we will be able to look on our lives and know why. Perhaps for the first time, the connections will have been drawn by the provident Lord's gentle touch. But it does not necessarily mean that we will be able to account for it all. But we will have him. We will be possessed by him and possess him in turn. And that, in a certain sense, is everything.
And now we bring you the interview with Matt Gambino.
So that's what I got.
Thank you.
Thank you.
So the suffering brings us closer to God.
Not necessarily.
But it can.
Suffering well can.
It can. Yeah. Okay, so why do we pray for intentions? If God is perfect and he wants us to be, you know, happier than we want us to be, why don't we just pray that for God's will in everything?
You can do that. So that is, I'll give you a kind of dry to mystic answer for that. So God could do everything immediately, okay? He could carry out all of his plans simply at a word, you know, like, let there be a happy family with all of their vocations sorted. And then it was, you know, the work of the seventh day. But God has his plans come about through intermediaries, okay? Not because he lacks the power to do it immediately, but because he's good, okay? So, not only do we get the grace of being passive recipients of his divine life, but we also get to be agents in dispensing it, okay? So, like, think about the Blessed Virgin Mary. Jesus could have taken flesh in any way he saw fit. He could have burst forth, fully formed from the thigh of Zeus, okay? But he took flesh in the womb of the Blessed Virgin Mary. Why? Because now we have a mother in the order of grace. It's somehow better that way, you know? And so, like, why does God answer our prayers? Well, he inspires in us the desire to be agents in his work of bringing about the redemption of the world. So he actually prompts you to pray for what it is that he wants to bring about, such that you could be an agent in the ministration thereof. It's not because, like, he needs you to pray in order to do it. He already, I mean, the desire that you have to pray for that thing is a gift of his.
Really?
Oh, yeah. You don't, also, like, prayer doesn't change God's mind. God isn't, like, sitting in, like, a dais in heaven, like, I am so somnolent and lazy, I hope no one stirs me to action today. No, it's like, God is already planning to carry out all things well. It's just a matter of how. And he prompts you to be somehow involved.
But he prompts you to ask for something, and that something doesn't happen.
Yeah.
It happens some other thing differently. Why doesn't he prompt you to ask for that different thing?
So, also, we, like, I think it's important to recognize the fact that prayer is also something that's on the way.
Mm-hmm.
So we only learn how to pray perfectly at the end.
Okay.
Because it's only at the end where the only thing for which we will ask is him. You know? So ultimately, the answer to all prayer is, I am, you know? Jesus is present to you. Because that's what we want for ourselves and for our loved ones, you know? And oftentimes we don't quite have the grammar to express that, you know? But Jesus is always giving himself in prayer. And so we say that every prayer asked in Jesus' name, God answers. Because ultimately, he's giving himself, okay?
Yeah.
So what ought we then to pray for? St. Thomas says we ought to pray devoutly and perseveringly. That's two adverbs. And then we ought to pray for things of salvation and always for ourselves, all right? So four things, devoutly and with perseverance, things of salvation, and for ourselves, okay? Everything else we are encouraged to, but it doesn't have the same kind of core conviction,
mm-hmm.
right?
About suffering, though, how is that difficult to carry the cross? Why is it, I mean, because it's difficult when you have a cross. How is it that it's so difficult even when you put it in, when you surrender it?
I suppose, I mean, it differs for every person, but just kind of like, an overarching reason as to why is because material.
I guess it's to persevere on carrying it.
Oh, yeah. Well, it's because, like, so on account of, we were created Not that life be difficult, but that life be good, happy, and easy. Okay? So we were created in grace in a way that was far easier to choose God. So we were created in original justice. That is to say that our minds were subordinated to God, our lower powers to our higher powers, and our bodies to our souls. So there was this kind of beautiful, articulated order within our lives. So we could look at the things of this earth, and we could say, like, okay, in this moment I am attracted to a plate of chocolate chip cookies, and I'm also attracted to a holy hour. I know that by overindulging in chocolate chip cookies, I will be tired from, like, insulin shock, and that I won't be able to have a fruitful holy hour. What I'll do is I'll make my holy hour, and then I'll come home. I'll have a chocolate chip cookie and a half with a bit of coffee and a delightful evening. You know, so like, you were able to do that with a kind of lucidity proper to a grace life. But now, like, what we see in most decisions is like, cookies. You know, like, and that's as far as we get. Because material goods tend to just overwhelm us because they are so immediately delicious and appealing, alluring. You know, the payoff is immediate. It's like, cookies, tasty, good. Okay? Whereas with spiritual goods, at least initially, they're kind of forbidding. What do we associate prayer with? Like falling asleep and fending off distraction, you know? At least initially. It's only subsequent to persevering in devout prayer that we begin to reap the spiritual fruit in such a way that it translates to like our psychological processes. When I pray, I am better. When I pray, I experience intimacy with Jesus Christ. When I pray, I'm a better son, I'm a better father, I'm a better sister, brother, whatever, you know? So, like, it's just because we're embodied persons, we have desires for both sensible and spiritual things, and it's just that sensible things just are more alluring. So we're always going to flee bodily pain, you know? It's just like...
Father Greg, thinking of the Psalms, how important is it an attitude of surrender and yet of hope in God's power in the midst of suffering?
Right. So, hope is the most overlooked of theological virtues, which is to say it's the one of the three that we hear least about. And that's a kind of traditional lack, I suppose. Like even in St. Thomas' Summa, there are some 16 questions devoted to faith. There are another 24 devoted to charity, and there are 6 devoted to hope. And maybe it's just the case that the dynamic of hope is more simple than that of faith, or charity, or just traditionally we've used kind of different means of explaining the faith that lean more heavily on faith and charity. But yes, I mean, hope is essential for salvation in the sense that, like, what is hope? By hope, we kind of have a certain trust, a certain faithful trust that God himself will give salvation. Because he's merciful and because he's all-powerful. So it's a way of seeing God as giver of eternal life that's not just like generically true, but actually pertains to me. So I think to like live in the modern world and not commit suicide entails like having friends, you know, and there's no greater friend than the divine friend. And it's really, it's like if that relationship is disordered, then there's a kind of chaotic disorder in the rest of our lives. It's difficult to persevere in love, but for the grace of friendship of God, you know, giving his divine life in a way that's real, particular, you know. Not only are my promises true, but they're true for you in a way that's, I don't know, that resonates in a way that fits.